Imagine earning continuing education credits while doing exactly what you're doing right now. Well, you can. Gable Media has revolutionized the way you earn your continuing education credits with a groundbreaking approach. Forget running around town and scouring the internet for credit-worthy courses. Fulfill your CE requirements effortlessly by listening to engaging podcasts just like the one you're listening to now. Our podcasts are designed to educate, entertain, and inspire, all in a user-friendly environment. But wait, there's more. Architects, Gable Media is also approved as an AIA Continuing Education Services provider. Upon completion, we handle everything, from reporting your hours directly to the AIA to storing your certificates in your personal Gable Media profile for your self-reporting needs. So follow the link in the show notes and start earning your credits in the most innovative and entertaining way possible with Gable Media.
All right, Entree Architect community, welcome to the backstage area of Context and Clarity. Every Thursday afternoon on Context and Clarity Live, Catherine McPhail and I and our live audience talk with a special guest to search for clarity around the things that matter most to you, the architect, no matter what your context is. You may be the employee of a firm dreaming of doing your own thing, or maybe you've had a firm for a year or 10 years or 20 years, and you're starting to rethink or reimagine what that firm could or maybe even should be. Every week, we cover topics that fall under the broad umbrella of the business of architecture, and they're all the need-to-know topics for the success of architects just like you. If we've never met before, my name is Jeff Eccles, and what you're about to listen to is the audio recording of a conversation that my co-host, Catherine McPhail, and I had with a special guest. Or will it be guests from the Context and Clarity community? All of this to break down last week's Context and Clarity Live conversation. So thanks for joining us as we all share our biggest takeaways and look for ways to apply what we heard in the Context and Clarity Live conversation to our own businesses. Let's get into it. All right, welcome to the backstage area of the Context and Clarity Studios. This week on Context and Clarity Live, Mandy Freeland and I talked to Jonathan Siegel. He's an architect, a developer, and the creator of the Architect as Developer courses. We wanted to know what our audience thought, though, about the conversation with Jonathan. So we've invited Isra Banks to join us backstage. Isra is an architect and the founder of Trivec Architects and an educator at the Boston Architectural College in Boston, Massachusetts. So Isra, welcome backstage.
Thanks for having me. I'm so excited.
It's great. It's great to have you here. One of the things that we like to do for these backstage conversations is match our, what those of you that are just jumping into this don't know, that Isra is a mystery guest at this point. Nobody knows who the guest is until the podcast is published. And we try to match up our mystery guests with a topic that they are passionate about, something they think is really interesting. And it was great to match Isra up with this conversation with Jonathan Siegel and the conversation of architect as developer. So really appreciate your enthusiasm and willingness to be here, Isra.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. And I really appreciate that you have thought of me as someone who would match Jonathan Siegel. So I want to say something. I never had any interest in finance before I figured out that, I didn't say I figured out, but I feel that becoming an architect developer is the answer for solving most of the profession's problems. And seeing Jonathan Siegel talking to today proved that everything I thought is right. Like he uses the word control, but I think it's more of freedom of applying all the things that we learn in school and being efficient in the same time and making these decisions. I think that's a perfect solution to everything we talk about in Entree Architect and all the problems that we have in our profession.
I think that's a really great point. He does talk about control, and I think that is important. I think that's an important word. I think it's an important concept. And I you know, you say freedom, and I was, as you were saying that, I was thinking, and I think that's what comes out of having that control, right? Is the freedom to do these things and the freedom to maybe it's a chicken and egg thing. I don't know. It might be catch 22, but it might be working on itself. But you have the control, which gives you the freedom to control the things that matter most to you. I thought that was a pretty amazing conversation. Jonathan says that it's all simple, that it's all simple math and things like that. I don't agree with that. I don't think it is. I think he's learned a lot in 33 years. But I think it's achievable is I guess the point, really.
The math looks simple. It's not getting the first part of the money is difficult, but what he made, the thing that he made look simple is being the person who is running all these things. Not just the math. The math is for architects, and I'm sure it's. I did take a real estate finance course, and it's pretty simple. But being the person, he made it look very easy to be the person who is going after putting together the deal, putting the design, coming up with the idea, which is something architects can do, and being the GC. From other people who I heard over the years did try going into let's say design and build and doing design, develop and build, they said it's very difficult to be the same person who does the drawings and go on site and be the superintendent and manage, do the everything that the GC does. But for Jonathan, I think with the experience, and probably he has his strength and all these qualities and the knowledge and the leadership, he was able to do it all. He's doing the property management. He's doing the design and build, and he's running it all. And that's not easy. That is definitely not easy.
Can't be. It cannot be.
Yeah. It's pretty difficult.
I wonder, and we didn't get into this in the conversation, but I wonder at this point how many people, because he's obviously the face of Jonathan Siegel, you know, architect and developer, but how many people does he have working with him on these projects? That would, if we had another hour to talk to him, that might be a direction we could take the conversation. Because it's got to be, yeah. At the very end, we talked about that management, which you're property management, which you're alluding to there. that just blew my mind. It's like there's another layer, layer of what he's.
And we didn't talk about being a witness expert. Is a forensic architect part. And from the conversation, we heard him talking a lot about taking things to mediation. So it seems like probably he gained the experience of being a witness from doing all these, you know, being on the job site and learning from the mistakes that he and other contractors done. So everything is tied together.
Yeah, that's a good point. And if you're listening to this and you aren't aware, Context and Clarity is a conversation that we have every day, 5 days a week. And we typically shape the week around a theme that we're going to talk with our Context and Clarity live guest about. So this week it was Jonathan Siegel, architect and developer. And we went all kinds of directions with that conversation. But we really shaped this week to run in parallel with Jonathan's career, basically, and his work. And so I believe it's yesterday as we record this, so it would be Wednesday, October 20th, we talked about forensic architects and expert witnesses. That was our topic for the context and clarity conversation, because Jonathan Siegel offers expert witness services. And we did not get to that in the conversation today with Jonathan, which is fine, but it's just, you know, just another facet of who he is and what he does.
So I think he, in this conversation, even though it was a 1 hour and big part of it was about cars, but I think he laid it out, at least for me, he laid out a roadmap for how to get started. Start with your own house, then probably two, I don't know if he meant by one house, one or two units, but it's just your own house, then four, then six, then eight. And then you can, after that, you can have large, probably 16 and a larger development. And I think, and he made really good points, and keep the property for 10 years so you don't get litigated. And then there is another movement called BRR, that's not for architects, BRR, they start renting and pulling the money out of it. And so I think it works in line with that movement. And then he's collecting the rent. He can use that money to buy a new property. I think he laid out a really solid foundation for someone, only 1 hour, for someone who wants to get into that foundation. Another observation I had is, he talked about commercial office buildings, and he said, I don't recommend it because it's problematic. And my professor, when I was taking the, not an architecture, I was taking, last year I was taking a real estate finance, he said, well, all the profit is in the commercial, and I am not sure how the residential works, and probably it's not profitable. But I'm positive that Jonathan Siegel is proving him wrong. He did not do the residential part. I mean,
well, I think hearing Jonathan speak in the past at conferences and interviews and things, one of his qualities, and we did not talk about this in the conversation today either, but I think one of his qualities is really understanding the marketplace. And he's talked before, he usually says that they were lucky. He talks about serendipity, but there's sometimes you make your own luck, right? You're paying attention and you can see what's coming, what's going on. And I think he said it while we were recording today. We talked to him for a few minutes before we went live as we were doing our tech check, but he was talking about the need for housing, in the residential market. And if I look at that and to the idea of office space right now, I mean, my guess is that if you are an office developer or manage office space right now, you're going to be decimated in the next year, 5 years, 10 years, just for COVID and everything that has happened. So, I think I would much rather be on the residential side of the equation right now.
There's always need for housing. Always there's need. So about you, I probably, this is off topic, but you see the strip malls and how they're dying, and the probably in a couple of years they're going to turn into offices or clinics, and then the office market would be flooded with properties, and they just don't know what to do with them. But for residential, that you can't like turn a strip mall into, I don't know, it would be a bit more difficult to turn a strip mall into residential. Or maybe you can.
We'll see. We'll see who has a creative idea for that. So, Mandy, I know you were at, Jonathan mentioned the education summit for AIA California. We talked about education a little bit. And so you were at that summit where he spoke. What were your biggest takeaways about this conversation, and maybe even about the summit when he was speaking at the summit?
So the summit, hi everybody, just getting my my voice into the conversation. You guys are doing an excellent job recapping the talk with Jonathan today. But so just going back to the education summit that AIA California hosted last week, Jonathan was a guest and he came in at the end with an idea of looking at what we have for our existing accredited degree program for architecture, the 5-year professional degree, or, you know, whatever the professional degree is, you know, master's, whatever. But he says take it back a notch, make it 4. There's probably, and I'm just like summarizing what he said, not trying to put words in his mouth, but from what I took from what he said was, we spend way too much time on theory, on architecture theory, on the basics of design, when we should be maybe focusing on how we apply architecture in the real world, in being a developer, in working and understanding economics, and what the community needs. We push for that a lot in serving the community as architects.
Yes.
So integrating that into the architecture education is seems like a natural fit instead of solely focusing, or, you know, the education programs that solely focus on theoretical design so much. I think that it leaves the new graduates unprepared for the real world of transitioning and continuing to get their license that next 3 years. Hopefully you get it done in 3 years, but three more years is needed to get your license. That apprenticeship time should be adapting to the real world, making architecture, you know, integrate into the community, learning development, learning where the money comes from, learning how the economics affect everything else. Everything that he said is stuff that we talk about all the time. As architects, so his take, just, you know, back to the summit, is less education, less architecture education. Like, let's get them into the real world. Let's give them experience, you know, working in construction or working in development, working for developers. Let's give them that extra piece so that they can become more of a whole architect instead of just putting lines on paper, right?
Yeah. Well, to that point, I mean, he mentioned in our conversation today that something like 3% of students come out and actually are quote-unquote designers, right? They're the ones that are designing the projects that you see. And, you know, if you start your own residential design firm, that breaks that mold, I'm sure. But, you know, I remember my first job out of school at a large firm in Chicago, we had someone who was called the senior designer, right? And 99% of the design that happened came right out of the end of his pencil. So, so he says, what do you say? 3% become designers, but we're spending 30% of our class time learning the things that we're not going to use if you know, if you're not one of those 3%. And I think that's a pretty strong point there.
It's worth talking about. It's worth reevaluating how we're preparing our graduates and what we're preparing them for. Like, are we preparing them to just, I mean, so just taking a step back, the new graduates that come out, they get hired and they're technical staff for a long time, production staff for a long time. And that's, and I think I'm on Jonathan's side. I think that's a waste. I think that, that even though they were trained to do design, a lot of design and a lot of hard studio hours and a lot of sweat and all of that stuff, that there are more practical things that we can teach to be impactful in our communities. And like he said, take control of these projects, be the leaders, understand zoning, like understand the impacts of how development impacts the communities and stuff.
He, that reminded me that I just lost my train of thought. He was talking about the 3% that design. Oh, and then he was talking about that he can see a future where if you wanted to, I don't remember the type of building that he used this as an example, but if you're going to, if you are a CEO and you need to build a building, why wouldn't you go to the contractor? You know, from, and again, this is going to offend some architects. I know it. You know, I know it. I knew it when he was saying it. I know it as I'm saying it right now. But practically speaking, if you're the CEO, why wouldn't you go to a contractor and say, I want you to hire an architect under your umbrella? Because it in a way, it makes more sense to have that single point of contact be the person that actually provides the physical product. And so, you know, you get into to that type of potential future, which I think is, to me, sounds very realistic. And it reminds me, we've not had him on Context and Clarity Live, but he spoke to my pro practice class last year. Neil Leach, who teaches in California and other places in the world, but he's got a book coming out in a little over a month called AI and Architecture. And he studies AI and amazing to hear him talk. Maybe we'll have him on Context and Clarity at some point. But when we were talking to him, my class and I were talking to him last year, you know, I'm on board. I'm just amazed. You know, oh my gosh, look at this technology and what it does and what it can do and all of this. And he got to the point, and I think it was one of the students asked a question, and he said, it was about adaptation, architects adapting AI in their practices. And he said, it's not going to be the architects that are embracing the technology, right? It's not going to be you, Mandy, or you, Isra, saying, yeah, wouldn't it be great if I used AI? And then this sort of being a tipping point to a bunch of architects going, the technology really is cool. He said, it's going to be because your clients demand it. And I think as I was sitting there that my chin probably hit the table. It was that moment. It's like, you're exactly right. The clients are going to drive that. And, you know, similar to Jonathan's point in, you know, with the CEO, the client can drive that. So what are we doing in relation to that? What are we doing to prepare ourselves, prepare our young people, the future of the profession? What are we doing to prepare them for that future? I think that's a big hole.
I think we touched on that briefly in Clubhouse when you mentioned that in your class, your students, or something I mentioned, that the architectural students need to specialize. And instead of having all students spending, let's face it, not all architecture graduates are great designers, and there is no point of having them spend, I don't know, thousands of hours designing and doing, they need to learn basics about design, but some of them needs to have knowledge in development, and teaching design to developers, I saw that program and it doesn't look successful. I think it would be more bang for your bucks if you teach development to architects than teaching design to developers. And the organic developers doesn't want to go to school anyway. They do have the money and they have the market knowledge and that's it. So, but if architectural school was teaching people specializing groups into architects, developers, architects, contractors, architects who are focused on codes and litigation and things like that, become witness experts. That would, and then also, of course, we have like the type of developments and hospitals and things like that, because we are required to do, like some of us do 4 years and then masters, of course. So if you want to do your masters, you have to have a specialty. You can't just go do your masters and then again graduate without a specialty. It doesn't make sense. So I think if we specialize and have that, that would also make a lot of sense. It would help. Like, I remember when I was in school, a professor who had just retired, he was a program director, and he said, some of you are going to be architects, some of you are going to be writers, some of you, and we're great. That was our final course. Some of you are going to be educators. And that's okay. You should embrace that. You can't. I've never seen a whole bunch of students, all of them graduate and become architects. And we were all, what? What? But it made a lot of sense later on.
It's kind of shocking in your last course, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. It makes sense, though. I think what you were referring to is when we were talking about that on Clubhouse was that one of my students suggested that maybe, and coincidentally, we had gotten on the topic of architect as developer in class that night. And then it went to architectural education, and you know it all seems to wind itself around itself. But one of my students said that maybe we need to have something like doctors, where what do you call it when the doctors they have their rotations when they are it's not their internship. The residency. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, so when they're in the residency, they have their different rotations. And my student was suggesting we could do the same thing with architects. They could have a 1 or 2 year residency, so to speak, and focus on all those specialties that you're talking about, and come out and go into that specialty for their career after that. And I thought that was a great idea.
It is. I'm gonna advocate for that. If anyone gonna ask me, I'm gonna propose that.
I don't know what it is about the makeup of my class this semester, which is pro practice class, and we do a little bit differently than the normal pro practice class, but there are a number of them that are keyed in on this idea of design build development, things like that. So I think there were several of them watching this conversation with Jonathan today. So that was pretty cool to have them be able to be a part of the conversation. Is there, when we think about the topic, architect as developer, which I guess is sort of a take it or leave it approach. You know, there's not a ton of middle ground other than just maybe design build, but, and it's not going to be for everybody. It's not going to be for every project type, but with everything that we talked about and Jonathan talked about in this conversation, do the two of you see any direct applications to what you do today? Or has it inspired you to do something different in the future? I'm curious about that.
So in my firm, I already do a service for developers, for commercial developers. And something that I learned in a design build firm, a contractor, general contractor led design build firm that I worked at in the 2000s, learned how to do planning, learned how to work on the very initial stages with developers on working with real estate, marketing, research, finding the right mix, sort of retail commercial mix use kind of stuff. So in my own firm, I do offer that service of working with developers, and I partner up with a civil engineer. And we do it together in my region. I don't know how it's done everywhere else, but commercial developments, the developers typically go straight to the civil engineer to start working with land, you know, dividing the land and just entitlements on the land and all that stuff involved. But They start with the civil engineer doing the site design. And so I feel that might be a weakness on their side, that it might benefit them to do a partnership with civil engineer and architect together so that we develop a cohesive, great end product site together. So not that I would take the lead as developer myself, but I feel that knowing that and having the experience working with developers and partnering up and offering an alternate service, like a non-traditional service, with my architecture skills, to developers, it helps them on the front end. You don't have to do full building design. You just have to lay it out, do something conceptual, make sure you, I mean, we're really good at doing research. We're great. I mean, that's what we do. We do design and research. But going through and working with the civil engineer and developing the commercial, retail, you know, restaurants, all that stuff, it's a great service. And, you know, business-wise on my side, if the client ends up not working out, if they end up not having the money, they didn't invest too much in the project. They didn't do full services contract with me. They did preliminary, conceptual, just enough to get their feet wet, just enough to see if they have funding. It's low commitment on their side. It's quick on my side. I think it's, so it's something that I like to use in my practice right now, I guess. So I think I will continue doing it if that's the question. But I think it's a great service for us to offer. And it's great for us to know that we can get in on the very front side of these projects and make them right in the first place. Right?
Yeah, that absolutely reminds me of the conversation that we had 8 weeks ago, actually, if you're counting in context and clarity time. On Context and Clarity Live, 8 weeks ago, we had James Petty, who's the author of Architect and Developer. What's the subtitle? Guide to Self-Initiating Projects, I think, is the subtitle of his book. So you're both reaching for your shelves.
I think it's up there somewhere. Yeah.
Yeah. So one of the things that James said related to what you were just talking about, Mandy, was that, you know, if you're not getting to that front end of the project, then by the time someone raises their hand and says, I need to hire an architect, all the decisions are already made. And I thought that was so on point, so powerful when he said it. And you're saying it now, and I think that's exactly right. It's how early can you get into the process to bring your best value? Let's be honest about it. Your best value is probably in that front end. You may do a bang up job on construction documents, but I am willing to bet that is not the highest value that you bring to a project. So I love that. Yeah.
That's the biggest thing. And then another point when we talked at the beginning, you told me something about you need a lot of guts, but I argued that being an architect and not making these decisions and putting yourself out there to take all the blame and take the bullets for things you haven't decided takes more guts. It's more risky. And I like how Jonathan Siegel has wrapped it up in the circle of the integrated delivery method. And he said, I'm the developer, I'm the owner, I'm the architect, and I'm the GC. And yeah, it's a lot of work, but he's taking the risk, and he is sure that no one is going to sue him. And that's the beauty of it.
Yeah. Yeah. I did like that. So geometric analogy, right? He used the triangle, which is the traditional model with the client, the architect, and the contractor. And then he said, there's this circle with everybody in the middle. Yeah, you just described it perfectly.
Yeah, the integrated delivery method. I have sometimes I've been in projects where integrated delivery method was the way, and it seemed to be very efficient. But sometimes when we touch on it in class, some students would argue, well, why would the architect give their voice and give their voice on and share it with the others and let them make decisions, let's say, like reaching out to engineers and authorities and civil engineers and everyone, but it's efficient. And I argue that the architect should not, they have the authority, but they're also doing the research, doing their part by listening to everyone on discussing things. So then the process of design development, there's no value engineering. The process of design development is going to be pretty easy. And the time is proven to be shorter, but make it more efficient and make that person, there's only one person who's doing everything. No, he's not, of course, he's relying on everyone else's expertise, but he's taking the whole risk. And that's great.
Yeah. And I think one of the big keys, and I don't know if this is a misnomer or not, I don't know if people misunderstand this or not, but now we've had two really great architect as developer guests on Context and Clarity. And I think we really need to understand that the risk versus reward equation works much better in your favor on the architect as developer side, because if you are the architect, there's risk. If you are the builder, there's contractor, there's risk. If you're the developer, there's risk, and so on and so forth. But each one of those characters in the story is compensated somehow. And the really glaring problem is that, let's just say that your fee, your architectural fee, architecture only fee, is somewhere between 7 and 10% or whatever it is. You're capped at that, and your risk doesn't end when you've drawn the last line, right, in your construction docs, or your last site visit for CA, or whatever, you know, wherever you draw the line, you've wrapped up the project, you close the file, and you move on. It doesn't stop there. You're not compensated beyond that point, but your risk keeps going. And, you know, in these models that that these guys, James Petty and of course today Jonathan Siegel, talk about, you're being compensated as an architect, as a builder, as a developer. And yes, there's risk in all of those, but you structure things to mitigate risk, and you keep getting paid. Your compensation keeps going. It doesn't end when the last nail is driven or whatever the analogy is. But the risk versus reward equation is way out of whack on the architecture side, which I find very fascinating about these conversations. Hopefully these have inspired some in the community to like Jonathan said, if one person decides to jump in and do this, then his time was well spent. And I agree. I'd love to see some more from the community start to develop their own projects.
So for me, the number one motivation to become a developer is to be able to implement everything I've learned without being, you know, stopped. Everything I stand for, everything I learned, I want to put it there, out there, and make people, you know, enjoy it. And I think that's the biggest disappointment in my professional career as an architect. Like, there's always someone who would say, "Oh no, I don't want this way."
I think one of the biggest takeaways that you'll get developing your own projects or building your own projects, you know, either one, is learning the decision making process and why things are done better on your plans, why certain materials are selected, like easier to get, quicker to ship, easy to assemble, doesn't take technical, specialized tools or anything to put together. All these things, like, we don't know this stuff, and we won't know this stuff until we build our own and develop our own projects. But there's a lot that goes on in the build part and the development part that we could improve on our side, on the architecture side, by knowing more of that side. Definitely.
Yeah, we talked about that before we hit record, and somebody asked the question. So if you're listening to this and this was your question, I apologize. I didn't catch who asked the question. We didn't get it in front of Jonathan. But the question was, does being a developer make you a better architect? And I think that answer has to be absolutely yes to what you're saying there, Mandy. Yeah, I know we touched on the idea of education a little bit, and before we went live with Jonathan, we were talking about Woodbury in San Diego, where he co-founded the real estate development program. They shut Woodbury down; it's closed now. You know, I would love for there to be some programs where students are actually developing projects as part of their academic pursuit. I don't know if that's a master's. I don't know if that's a, you know, some separate certificate or whatever it is. But I absolutely believe that would turn out better architects. The more people that we have going through programs like that. So it's too bad that Woodbury shut down. I was doing the research leading up to the conversation today, and I was reading about Woodbury, and it's rated the number one real estate development program in the country, and all of this. And then Jonathan says, "Well, yeah, they suddenly shut it down." So that's a real shame. But maybe we can find some more of those sprouting up at other colleges and universities around. I'd love to see that. I'd love to be involved in that.
I bet you would. The education summit that took place last week, we talked about that. And we talked about one of the solutions, just the studio environment, the studio teaching environment gives you the opportunity, but it relies on the teacher, right, on the curriculum. We thought that maybe one of the solutions was to do that exact thing, work in real estate development, real world application into a studio. And so it's not just theoretical design, but actual real world, that we have a way, maybe just using the studios to make it work. So that's just one of the other solutions, helping the education side. And these conversations that have been happening the last couple of weeks on context and clarity open the door to a lot of people attending a lot of really great programs in the architecture schools here in the United States that integrate urban design, that integrate real estate. I'm learning so much that there are those programs out there. We would love to see those replicated, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I shared this the other day. I'm in Indiana. I'm in Indianapolis. And so I know Ball State really well because it's in Muncie, Indiana. That's where I teach. And I know Notre Dame really well. It's in South Bend, Indiana. And if they are any indication, I think there's a movement towards bringing the entire design and construction ecosystem into the colleges of architecture at Ball State. It's CAP, it's College of Architecture and Planning, whatever they're called. Notre Dame has real estate development inside and interior design, architecture, of course. And Ball State has architecture, landscape architecture, urban planning, construction management, and interior design all now inside, not real estate development. That's not an offering. But if that's a trend, that makes me hopeful. And I like the idea. You know, you could make studios more realistic. My feeling is it's going to need to be more than a semester to make it more realistic. That's one thing we suffer from in my class. We do the basically the Shark Tank final where they pitch their business idea and you just don't, you don't have enough time to fully develop. So you do what you can, right, in a semester, but anything to move it in I think a more realistic direction would be helpful.
Yeah, I have the same problem. And my courses are broken down into 8 weeks. Practice management, 8 weeks, project management, 8 weeks, and then construction and evaluation. So it's a pretty quick course. And
I guess I shouldn't complain about my 16 weeks. Yeah, I get a full 16, so with fall break and field trip week taken out, but it's more than eight, so I guess I'll count my blessings there. Well, any last word, any last thoughts on this conversation with Jonathan, architectural education, architect as developer, any last big takeaways or what you're going to do tomorrow with this information that we gathered today?
Well, I think it's not, we talked about he make it looks easy. So I think he gained all that experience from all over the years. So if someone who's starting, just probably me, not me, my probably 3 years future me, you hire a GC or hire a lot of people to learn from until you probably develop that confidence or that wealth of knowledge to be able to, you know, run the whole show. But yeah, find partners and learn from others. Mandy was making a great point about, like, we don't know much about lead time, about what's available, the prices of products. So yeah, and that is probably one of the important issues, when how to find good subs, good contractors, in addition to finding the initial amount of money, the initial.
Yeah. I think that's an important point. Jonathan Siegel has been at this for 33 years. He's doing a high-rise project now for the first time, I believe. As with anything, you know, we can't look at him where he is today and say, okay, how do I do that? Right? We've got to go back 33 years. And the great thing is he's sharing his knowledge and his information. We're not trying to sell his course, but he's got his architect, his developer courses. You have tools available to you that he didn't have, that he's helped develop. But go back, you know, he said it in the conversation today, start with your own house. James Petty said something very similar 8 weeks ago when we talked to him. So, you know, go back to the beginning with these examples, just like you would anybody, you know, any other, person you might look up to. That's the important part. You're jumping in and developing a high rise in the next few months. So that's a really great point.
And I love that he broke it down and made it not as scary. It's not scary. It's just steps. You just start small. You learn as you go. You grow bigger. That's how it works. You learn how the money works. You learn how to reinvest. You learn how long to keep it so you can keep as much money as you can to reinvest later. I love how he made it just an easy process. It's intimidating, and anything new for us is, you know, we just want to focus on plans and building science and appeasing clients, but stretching our wings into this development service or offering, or you know, even just being the developer ourselves for our own projects, that's, we can definitely do this.
Yeah, that's a good point. I didn't think about that until you said that, but we had Pat Flynn as a guest a couple of weeks ago, and one of my takeaways with Pat was he did such a great job of breaking things down into these little achievable steps. And that's exactly what Jonathan did today as well. And ironically, they're both in San Diego, for whatever that's worth. But you're exactly right. He broke it down There's still a lot of things he talked about that I don't understand, right? I'm not a finance guy. I suppose I could learn it. But by following these little steps that he broke it down into, I'm pretty sure I would have a better chance of being successful than if I just tried to eat the whale or whatever it is. How do you eat a whale? One bite at, or elephant. How do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time. So we're going to take it one bite at a time. That's good. Well, Izra and Mandy, thank you both for being here. I guess today I have two special guests with me today. Mandy, I really appreciate you filling in for Catherine. She's away at fiddle camp right now. For those of you that don't know, Catherine is a Scottish fiddler. She's at fiddle camp this week. So Mandy was kind enough to step in and take Catherine's place as the co-host today and did a fantastic job. So thank you for that, Mandy. And absolutely, it's great having you. And Izra, thanks for being our mystery guest. It's still a mystery as we record this, but I guess if you're listening to this by now, you figured it out. Izra is our guest. Izra Banks is our guest for Context and Clarity Backstage this week. So Izra, thanks for bringing the passion and the energy to this conversation. I'm so glad that you were able to be our special guest this week.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
I really absolutely great to have both of you. And for those of you out there listening, thanks. Thanks for listening. I hope you caught the conversation with Jonathan Siegel. If not, go back and listen to it. Obviously, we had a lot of great takeaways. We enjoyed the conversation. We learned a lot. I hope you did as well. And also, I encourage you. I've dropped a few names during this conversation, but we've been doing Context and Clarity since April 6th of 2020. We're up to about our 40th Context and Clarity Live, where we've had a special guest. So we've talked to a lot of people about a lot of topics. 8 weeks ago, like I said, James Petty, same topic, architect as developer. So we've had a solid 2 hours of conversations about becoming an architect and a developer. Those resources are out there. They're here. Wherever you're consuming this podcast right now, they're over on YouTube on the Entree Architect YouTube channel. And if you're an architect or an architecture student or working towards becoming an architect, I'd encourage you to go over to Facebook and check out the Entree Architect Community Facebook group. It is a private group just for architects and students and people working to become an architect. Almost 7,400 members from around the world. I looked at the stats the other morning. About 5,300 of those members have been active in the last month. So that tells you that there's a lot of really great conversations going on, a very supportive group. You can learn a lot. You can ask a lot of questions. You can share your knowledge wherever you are in the context of the conversation of the moment. It's a great place to be. So go check that out. Join us. It's the home of everything Context and Clarity. And we'll be back next week on Context and Clarity Live. We'll have Laura Teagarden, who is an architect in Indianapolis. She's a friend of mine. She's about 2 miles. I'm pointing west right now. She lives about 2 miles over there. And so we're going to talk to Laura about architecture, certainly, but she's published a couple of books. One is about taking the ARE, and her most recent is the Little Architect's Alphabet. So it's about teaching architecture to young children. So I think that'll be a fun conversation with Laura next Thursday, which will be October 28th. So join us for that. Context and Clarity Live, 4 p.m. Eastern on Facebook, on YouTube, on Twitch, and on LinkedIn. And then, of course, we're going to record this Context and Clarity Backstage with another mystery guest next week. Can't tell you who it is, but we're going to record that, our biggest takeaways from the conversation with Laura. So again, thanks for joining us. Thanks for making Context and Clarity a thing. Be well, be safe, keep those around you safe and well. Find a little bit of time to breathe, relax, rejuvenate, because we're going to do this again tomorrow. So I hope that I'll see you somewhere sometime soon. Thanks for listening, everybody. Mandy and Izra, thank you. Have a great evening. All right, well, now you know what we thought and what we're going to do with what we learned. But what did you think? What did we miss? I really hope that there was some big takeaway from the Context and Clarity Live conversation or from our breakdown right here that will help you with your business. DM me on Instagram or on Twitter and let me know what your takeaways were. You can find me on all the socials at Jeff_Eccles. So send me a message and let me know what your takeaway was. And if you want more conversations like this, subscribe to the Context and Clarity podcast and leave us an honest review and rating. Those things really help us to get the message out and help us to help more architects just like you. Oh, and follow Context and Clarity on Instagram as well. There you can get a heads up on everything that's coming up. In our next episode, Catherine and I will host Context and Clarity Live again with a new special guest and a new theme for next week. There's always something new to look forward to. And if you love content like this, check out Gable Media. It's a multimedia network for people that care about the built environment. And it's also the home of Context and Clarity. With Gable's growing family of podcasts and video channels, I know you'll find something there that interests you. You can learn more at GableMedia.com. That's GABLMedia.com. And finally, if the topic of today's episode is of particular interest to you and you'd like to dig deeper into it, then join me over in the Entree Architect Community Facebook group. That's where every weekday at 4 p.m. Eastern, I host Context and Clarity conversations, and we take topics just like this and we dig deeper. We have a conversation in real time to try to find more clarity around the things that matter most to you. So thanks for listening. I hope our time together has inspired you to think about your community and your practice and how you can support those around you. Catherine and I will be back for our next episode. And in the meantime, I hope you'll join me and the Entree Architect community on Facebook today at 4 p.m. Eastern so that we can help each other find more clarity around the topics that matter most, no matter what your context may be.
From historic homes to modern architecture, brick is one of the most popular building materials around the world.
How to allow the house to bridge the gap between the history of the site, the approachability of this kind of architecture in this kind of neighborhood, and the sort of nostalgia of materiality for the client's past, right? And brick really started to provide an answer for that.
Hi, I'm Doug Pat, and this is Design Vault. There aren't many materials that easily blend with any style and context, but brick does just that. I've seen some extraordinary work with brick, so when Glengarry approached me about hosting this podcast, I couldn't say no.
Typically, Tudor-style houses from outside are just stunningly gorgeous piece of structure. And when you go in, it's just sad.
Yeah.
Dark. And that is not going to happen with my approach to design.
I speak with industry leaders and share inspiring stories behind their work and ingenious design.
You'll see brick that's fashioned into basket weave patterns, sawtooth patterns. What's known in England as diapering.
Doesn't sound like you knew them per se, right? They found you through relationships that you had with other.
Well, wait, Doug, there's more.
Okay.
We'll go behind the scenes to understand process and even the inspiration that sparked the design.
You know, I think we were inspired by all the factory buildings in Dumbo. I mean, that is the kind of period of significance, that early American factory building.
Design Vault by Glengarry. Visit glengarry.com/design-vault or search for Design Vault wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe now to stretch your imagination.